Thanks so much, Joanne, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. I must admit I'm a newcomer to this meeting, and already I'm a little nervous. I'm a little nervous in part because you just heard two very elegant talks about technologies and tools that you can use to solve problems of quality and errors at the ground level. And what I'm going to talk to you about is a view from 30,000 feet or higher, so it's a little bit backwards. The idea of this talk is to provide you a burning platform, but I also recognize that in that regard, I'm probably preaching to the choir, but they've asked me to preach just the same. And so with those concerns, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about errors, safety, quality, specifically in surgical pathology. And my goal is that over the next 40 minutes or so, you will take away an idea about listing and assessing patient safety risks in your own practices, wherever they might be, and that you can have an idea about how you might develop strategies for doing something about it. So those are the objectives of our time together. How many of you have read this report? This was released in 1998 by the Institute of Medicine to Air is Human. And although it's surprising the number of physicians who've not yet read this report, as we approach its 10th anniversary, all of your administrators have read this report, and all of your payers have read this report. This is a report that was released in November as part of the Quality of Healthcare in America project launched in June of 1998, and the charge given to this group was to develop a strategy that would result in threshold improvement in quality over the next 10 years, and as we approach the 10-year anniversary, I would argue that it was remarkably successful. The vehicle for executing that charge was really this report, and they began by telling some powerful anecdotal stories. And, of course, organized medicine's initial response was, those are just stories. We're scientists, we like data. But as we've also learned, stories are not about validation, they're about inspiration, and these stories were inspirational. They told the story about Betsy Lehman, a health reporter for the Boston Globe. She reported on healthcare, and she died from an overdose of chemotherapy at one of the country's leading cancer centers. They told the story about Willie King, who went to the operating room to have one leg removed and woke up with the other one gone. And they told the story about Ben Kolb, a little 8-year-old boy who went for a very minor procedure that ended his life due to a medication error. Now, those are just stories. That's not validation, but it's inspiration. Then they provided some data. Again, medicine's initial response was to quibble about the data, but that didn't look too good in the eyes of the public. They cited a couple of studies, one in New York, one in Colorado, that suggested that if you extrapolated their observations, somewhere between 44,000 to 98,000 Americans die every year as a result of medical errors that occur in the course of their care. There were some editorials in some of our journals that said that number is not the right number. But believe me, that wasn't really the point. To put it in perspective, the authors of this report said that medical errors exceed the number of deaths attributable to the 8th leading cause of death. This was more than motor vehicle accidents. This was more than breast cancer. This was more than AIDS. And that got the public's attention. And to get the payer's attention and to get the government's attention, they put dollar figures to it, and they said the cost of these errors, we estimate, to be somewhere between $17 and $29 billion a year. And they said the goal of this report is to break the cycle of our collective inaction. And they anticipated the response. They said, despite the cost pressures, despite the liability constraints, despite your resistance to change and any other seemingly insurmountable barriers you may want to talk about, the point is it's simply not acceptable for patients to be harmed by the very healthcare system that's supposed to offer healing and comfort, period. Well, still, lots of doctors haven't read the report. I think medicine's initial response was, perhaps this will go away. Pathology's response was, I hope they recognize they're talking about someone other than us. But pretty soon, we were unveiled in places much more visible than this Institute of Medicine report. So, for example, in April of 01, we were in Good Housekeeping, with a worldwide circulation of millions. The title, pretty big font, nice colors, said, When Doctors Make Mistakes. Read the subtitle. Misread pap smears, lost lymph nodes, the wrong diagnoses. Oops. The details were five chilling real-life stories. Chilling was their word, but I think it's appropriate. One of them was, and this is a quote, the surgeon called Kastrup, the patient was identified by name, in her office and confessed that the lymph nodes had never made it to the lab. Any of you ever heard of lost specimens? Raise your hand if you've ever heard of a lost specimen in your home enterprise. At that time, I was at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and one of my clinical colleagues brought me a copy of Good Housekeeping and said, does this ever happen here? I said, yes, with low frequency, but we could end up in Good Housekeeping. How about that? The other chilling story, 1992, Joanne O'Kane, 31, of Frankfort, Illinois, scheduled her annual pap smear, the result negative. But nearly 3 years later, while pregnant with her third child, O'Kane was diagnosed with advanced cervical cancer. The earlier test clearly showed that she already had cervical cancer, a false negative. Now, the details of this case weren't really in print in this article, and we can quibble about whether that's a fair assessment of the circumstances, but the point is this is what our citizens are reading about the care that you and I offer. This became personal in Rochester, Minnesota in 2003. This was the headline, January 2003. It was very cold in Rochester. That's predictable. This actually came out on the very weekend that preceded the annual quality meeting at the Mayo Clinic, which started on Monday. And the headline said, "Hospital apologizes for removing woman's breasts." Now that's a way to capture the public's attention. This actually happened up the road in Minneapolis-St. Paul, 70 miles distant. But the article says tissue from McDougall's biopsy was switched with tissue from another woman. Anybody ever heard of switching up two specimens and thus misidentifying the patient? Same thing. As I walked into this large auditorium for the quality meeting on Monday morning, I was immediately swarmed by various members of Mayo leadership who said, "Have you read the paper?" "Yes." "Could it ever happen here?" "Yes." Wrong answer. The next month, February, this was on the tables in the waiting areas at the Mayo Clinic. Reader's Digest is one of the periodicals they put out for patients. There were hundreds of copies throughout the clinic. Very big font, Reader's Digest, fatal hospital mistakes, how to avoid them, a manual for avoiding death in hospitals. And to put that in perspective, this was of greater interest to the readers of Reader's Digest than Richard Gere's happiness and groundbreaking news regarding sex with aging, which was the bottom story. Couldn't compete. Reader's Digest has kept us on the front page, August of last summer, how doctors gamble with your life, seven ways to protect yourself, still providing manuals for avoiding death at the hands of your healthcare providers. And as I'll show you in a bit, pathology figures into this article as well. February of 2003, when we were more interested in hospital fatal errors than we were Richard Gere's happiness and sex with aging, was the same month that the story was riveted by the story of Jessica Santian. How many of you remember that story? It was an amazing story, right? About this immigrant from Mexico who came to this country for a life-saving transplant and got the wrong organs. This article says Jessica Santian, 17, is in critical condition on life support at Duke University Hospital, great medical center, after mistakenly being given heart and lung transplant from donor with an incompatible blood type. Her body rejected the organs, etc. They were hoping for the best at that time, but the story had a sad ending, as you might predict. Now, that's just the press, right? Always trying to make trouble, digging up these rare events and trying to make them bigger than in fact they are. Well, here's some data, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Pretty high-impact journal, pretty well-respected, not always right. This is survey data that was collected from 831 physicians and 1,200 members of public that were non-physicians. And they asked them, how often have you or your immediate family experienced errors in the course of your care? 40%, not rare. 40% of unselected respondents said, yep, it's happened to us. You say, well, they couldn't have been important. Well, 24% of the time, the non-physician public said, these had serious health consequences. How serious? How about death? Is that serious enough? So it's not just the press. It, in fact, is the experience. So the first conclusion I'd like to leave with you, and I think there are only four, is that there's no more hiding, right? You got to embrace this. The public is on to us, and they're not going to take it anymore, nor should they, nor should we. And the second thing is, significant errors, in fact, do occur in anatomic pathology practice at a low but absolutely predictable frequency. How often? I don't know. If you read the Wall Street Journal, it says about 1 in 100. Research at Johns Hopkins University has shown that about 1.4% of pathology cases involve serious errors. It is difficult to estimate an exact figure, but it's believed that several thousand patients each year are seriously misdiagnosed. I hear sometimes from my colleagues a little irritated. They say, this patient wants this case sent out. I don't get it. How could they not? My guess is they either read Good Housekeeping, Reader's Digest, or the Wall Street Journal. And they have this idea that you could be wrong. And they don't want you to be wrong. Well, is there more authoritative data beyond the Wall Street Journal? Sure. It's not very good data, but there is evidence that speaks to this question about how often we get it wrong, and maybe helps us understand how often that might be preventable. Some of the detection methods for errors in surgical pathology include secondary reviews or audits. Those are the most common. They're usually retrospective as opposed to prospective. And there's a difference between looking at consecutive or selected cases. So if you look at older literature that looks at how often we make significant errors in pathology sign-out, the number ranges anywhere from less than 1% to just over 1%. And historically, that was absolutely fine with us, right? We thought that was good. It's like 0.25%. How can you do any better than that? After the Institute of Medicine's first report, I became quite concerned that the way we had looked at this data historically wouldn't serve us very well going forward. And so when I went to our Continuous Improvement Council at the Mayo Clinic and said, you know, I think we need a new strategy which should be zero preventable errors, the pushback was the following. First of all, that's not achievable. And second of all, how do you know we're not there already? Right? So I looked at our QA data and I said, well, we have data that says our number was even lower than this. It's pretty low frequency, which I've always thought was great news. I paraded that data around to hospital leadership and said, look how great we are. And then I imagined the way these stories were being told in the press. And I imagined how I might end up on the front page of the weekend edition of the Rochester Post Bulletin. And I imagined what it would say was that Dr. Myers, who's presided over anatomic pathology for 10 years, has been satisfied with a rate of errors that guaranteed 10 patients annually would suffer adverse consequences. And so over his 10 years, he has presided over the death of about 100 patients. Doesn't look so good. Had trouble being proud. Thought maybe we hadn't been looking at this in the way we'd have to in the future. If we look at more recent data, this from Steve Robb and colleagues, published in 2005, who looked at, again, secondary review, which was retrospective, they identified discrepancies, which is not the same as error, and we'll get to that, at a rate of about 6.7%. Now, when you look at the sorts of changes and how they figured into that total, many of those were changes within the same category, so the kind that are unlikely to have adverse effects. But a substantial number were changes in what they described as categoric interpretation, benign to malignant, malignant to benign. And interestingly, what they observed was that the likelihood of a discrepancy was related to the trigger for the re-review in the first place. So, for example, if you looked at cases re-reviewed at the request of a clinician, 23% had diagnostic discrepancies that might have been significant. Now, why do you suppose that is? Now, clinicians would say it's because you didn't have the right expertise at the table, because they call their expert with whom they have a relationship, right? I would say the call came because a clinician saw the PATH report and knew that there was something we should have known and didn't. And when they shared that information, things changed. And that's what this meeting's all about, right? How we arm ourselves with the information we need to get the job right prospectively rather than after the fact. If you look at the likelihood of harm, the blue line, related to the trigger for the request, those that are done at the request of a clinician have a higher likelihood of being the sort of error that has the potential to result in patient harm. If you look at the discrepancies that we uncover in the course of our QA programs, the risk of harm is low, right? So, I mean, we spend a lot of time and energy in QA programs that discover problems that are, in a sense, non-problems, and we fail to capture the cases that doing something about matters up front, and it's an issue of sharing information. Andy Renshaw and colleagues saw similar changes in a private practice environment in Miami. They looked at the rates of diagnostic disagreement based on the trigger for re-review, and those that were re-reviewed at the request of a patient or a clinician, and those that came to them because the patient was being transferred to their medical center for care had the highest rates of diagnostic discrepancy. They were also careful to say discrepancy actually doesn't turn out to be the same as error. It's the surrogate we use in much of our literature for error, but it's not the same. In fact, what they did that others haven't done is actually looked at patient outcome, and for the subset of patients in which there were discrepant discoveries, looked at whether, in fact, the error was really an error, who was right and who was wrong. The blue lines are the number of patients total in each of these categories for which they had follow-up. The red line is the number that they characterize as errors once they had all the facts in hand. And notice that not all diagnostic discrepancies are errors, number one, and the likelihood that a diagnostic discrepancy is in fact an error that could impact the patient's care depends to some extent on the trigger for re-review in their practice. And they concluded that diagnostic disagreement is not the same as error, something important to remember. Another source of error detection rates in surgical pathology are rates of amended reports. There was a QPREB study to look at that with a large database over 1.5 million cases. And they identified well under 1% of cases that had amended reports, most frequently affecting the final diagnosis. That would suggest that the rates of error are low in most practices. There are prospective surveys that have looked at the rates of error detection or abnormalities or defaults in specimen processing. In this large Q-probe study, 6% of cases had some sort of specimen deficiency, as you'll see, many of them relating to information, 77%, in fact. And the point of all of that is that there are errors in surgical pathology at low rates that historically were acceptable and are no longer acceptable going forward, unless you want to be on the front page of USA Today, and I guarantee you can get there. And John Sinard and John Morrow had it right in 2001 when in an editorial in Human Path they said, look, there is going to be greater emphasis on process design and the development of error-resistant protocols, something we've never done well in surgical pathology, so as to make the whole system less susceptible to human errors, which are inevitable. It was the point of the title of the Institute of Medicine's report. And information systems will be key. And we can no longer settle for the level of performance that has satisfied us with LISs historically. So again, the second conclusion, significant errors occur in anatomic pathology at a low but predictable frequency, and that's all about information and information systems as tools to help us be better. So the question it raises, at least it raised for me, was how safe is our practice? I asked the question in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm now asking the question in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And you're asking the question at home. I think if you're thinking about the safety of your practice and errors, it's very important that you understand a definition for errors that makes sense for you and your group. Broadly speaking, you can categorize errors a number of ways. The Institute of Medicine's first report separated things into active errors, which are the errors that occur at the frontline operator level, and latent errors, which are the things that happen behind the frontline operator, but for which they're left holding the bag. And I would argue that most of our QA programs were built as if we were looking for active errors, but in fact we were identifying latent errors while blaming the frontline operators. Well, you're going to have to do something about that faculty person. They're not paying attention. Ever heard that? Now, sometimes that's actually true, right? I mean, this doesn't mean there's no such thing as a performance issue. This doesn't become an excuse for not paying attention to competencies. But it recognizes that at the end of the day, quality is absolutely a system property. So if you have a QA program that's really built on doing something about the competency of your individuals, you're missing the point. That may turn out to be an important component, but it's not the piece that will get you the biggest payoff. And at the end of the day, every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets, the words of Don Berwick. I love that quote. So what it meant was that we were absolutely guaranteed of making 10 serious errors annually at the Mayo Clinic. We were perfectly designed to achieve exactly that and couldn't possibly achieve anything different without changing the way we work. This is about the time that we like to talk about lawyers, but this really isn't about lawyers. This is data that Dr. Troxell collected from the doctor's company, and perhaps there's some things we can learn from this sort of data, but I'm nervous about letting lawyers drive the conversation about quality and safety. He collected some information in two time periods, 95 to 97, 98 to 2003. Those are the N numbers for each of these categories. Notice that if you look at 218 lawsuits that targeted pathologists during this time period, only 1.8% were considered operational errors, and all of those had to do with specimen and patient identification. Things had changed in 1998. The Institute of Medicine's first report came out in 1999. From 1998 to 2003, all of a sudden, operational errors were a bigger part of the conversation. Specimen patient misidentification was the biggest piece of that pie. They're on to us, and they're not going to take it anymore. The Wall Street Journal in June of last year said, hospitals moved to cut dangerous lab errors, and this report specifically mentioned the Mayo Clinic. Prior to that, we were quite proud of our reputation. Remain so today, but the public is trying to see it differently. Now, this article, turns out, was driven by some rather sinister elements that I'll not detail. But it doesn't matter. You know, that just sounds like whining once the cat's out of the cage. This author said, for patients, some of the most devastating medical mistakes can start in the lab. Wall Street Journal, in the lab, where studies show that 3 to 5% of the billions of specimens taken each year are defective, be it a biopsy that doesn't extract the tumor cells, blood that isn't drawn correctly, or a mix-up with another patient's sample. Paul Valenstein tried to look at it in a more scientific fashion, again, in collaboration with the CAP, that looked at identification errors involving clinical laboratories, so we've moved beyond the realm of surgical pathology for this data set, categorizing those misidentifications as discovered before reporting, identified after reporting, and or resulting in an adverse event. They had data from 120 institutions. It was a five-week study period. Again, they aimed to identify errors that were identified both pre- and post-verification, and they looked for whether or not those misidentifications were likely to have an adverse event. They predicted that it would sort out in this fashion. They were right. 85% of the identification errors were identified before reporting, great news. About 15% were identified after reporting, and a small number of institutions actually shared information about the number that resulted in an adverse event. There were a total of 345. When they looked at the reasons for identification errors, they had information for nearly 5,000 of these identification error events, and it was the specimen label over half the time and a problem with initial registration order entry nearly a quarter of the time. That's what you're all here about, right? I mean, that's the LIS. Those are the tools that we give to our employees every day. Now, it's not all about information systems. There are other complex processes in our laboratories. The second period of time that Dr. Troxell looked at this data set of lawsuits, floaters figured in for three. Notice there were none before, but yes, not only our clinical colleagues have learned about floaters, but so has the public. In fact, the readers of Reader's Digest now know about floaters. If you look at the text of this article, Gambling with Your Life, Millions of Medical Mistakes Happen in the Lab, here's how to protect yourself. It says, the sample her diagnosis was based on had been contaminated with cancerous cells from another patient's specimen. Ever heard of that? When my clinical colleagues learned that we had floaters, they were stunned. They said, how could you not have told us about those? To which I said, would you wanted to have known? I mean, it's scary to us. I can't imagine how scary it is to you, and please don't tell your patients. And how often do they happen? They happen a lot. Another CAP Q-probe study, very useful, looked at the number of floaters discovered prospectively, meaning in the course of sign-out, and then they went back and specifically looked for floaters and found them with a much higher frequency. But they occur in somewhere between 1 and 5% of cases total. Fewer number of slides, but if you look at it on a case basis, 1 to 5% of cases have these floaters that the readers of Reader's Digest now know all about. Right? And if you look at the sorts of tissues that contaminate those slides, the vast majority are normal tissues, which are unlikely to confuse the pathologist, although you never know. But the second largest category are abnormal or tumor bits, right? And that's the trap. If you see cancer on a slide, how do you know it came from the right patient? As opposed to from the microtome or from the cutting bench or from somebody's glove. And the third conclusion I would leave you then, all of that to say that our complex processes set us up to fail. This is about latent errors, the ones that live behind the front-end operators, but leave them holding the bag. The pathologist who signed out that woman's breast biopsy in St. Paul didn't set out to do her harm. But she's been named in the press, and she actually made it to an editorial in Newsweek. She was left holding the bag for something that happens in all of our laboratories. And it's a process issue. Every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. We have all designed laboratories and processes that ensure floaters at low frequency. What we haven't done is design a process to either reduce their prevalence or arm pathologists with information that would preclude acting erroneously on that event. We mostly just cross our fingers and hope for the best. Which really takes us to the second bullet of our objectives, and in many respects, this has been covered much more elegantly by the previous two speakers. So what do you do about that? I mean, you can worry about it, you can have anxiety about it, but can you do anything about it? And I think the answer is absolutely. In fact, in the Institute of Medicine's first report, they gave some hints. They said, look, first thing you have to do is provide leadership. How do you do that? You believe it. You embrace the message, and you go home and say, I'm not going to take it anymore. Throw the old QA data away. It won't work moving forward. And you also recognize that this isn't about blaming the people. You design processes that respect their human limitations. What does that mean? You avoid reliance on memory. This is the most common response to misdiagnosis or a flawed process in pathology, right? Gosh, I thought I told you to do it this way. I forgot. Well, try to remember. I will. And I'll forget. Right? Guaranteed. I'm human. Hell, these days I hardly remember anything. Use constraints and forcing functions. Avoid reliance on vigilance. You know, this has been a key to our QA programs. Be more careful out there. I thought I was. Simplify your key processes. Standardize your work processes. Use Lean and Six Sigma to get it right. Most of our processes have been designed by default, not by intention. And that doesn't work very well, and we've proved it. If we go back to Paul Valenstein's data, he said, look, here's the solution to identification errors. First of all, have the data. Monitor your performance. Ensure that your LIS gets it right up front at order entry, which means using multiple identifiers. And at the time of report verification, have a step that ensures you got it right. Steve Robb and colleagues say, do what Toyota does. Now, I would argue that actually, if you read the details of this paper, there isn't much Lean about it, but I think they've got the principle right. And one of those principles is standardization. All they did was standardize diagnostic terminology. Now, you wouldn't think that simply standardizing words would change performance, but it did. Standardizing words change performance. If you look at test sensitivity, specificity, in this case of thyroid aspirates, false negative rates, made a difference. Promote effective team functioning. Now, most doctors say we're great team workers, right? I had a great experience in my former life at the Mayo Clinic. There was an external consultant from the business world who wanted to spend a sabbatical at Mayo. So he spent 6 months kind of embedded at Mayo. And his whole career part of that had been in service in the business sector, not healthcare. But he was interested in service and its relationship in healthcare late in his career. He wanted to learn about that, so he spent 6 months. And I was there when he kind of came for his first presentation to Mayo leadership. It was interesting. It was an uncomfortable message. But one of the messages had to do with teamwork and communication. And I think Mayo does it pretty well, better than most places. And he said, you know, this is an interesting place. When I ask you doctors how well you do at teamwork at the Mayo Clinic, you all say, oh, we're fantastic. When I ask the nurses, they say, well, we got plenty of room for improvement. And he said, you know what, I think maybe they're a little closer to the truth. If I go back to that survey in the New England Journal of Medicine that asked families, some families of MDs, some families of non-MDs, and said, what do you think are the very important causes of the errors that your family experienced? The non-physician public put it number 3 on the list. The first one was, you don't spend enough time with us. The second one was, you're overworked, you're stressed, you're fatigued. We get that, but it's not an excuse. And the third one was, they said, you don't work together to communicate. You don't work as a team. Patients can see that. By the way, that was at the bottom of the list for doctors, right? Even doctors who experienced errors said, yeah, but I don't think that's a big player. The public sees it differently. If we go back to Jessica Santilla's case and look at Ellen Goodman's article, she says, in Jessica's case, the cause of death was the single most common error cited in high-risk professions from aviation to medicine, the failure to share key pieces of communication. In my experience, almost every big screw-up that I've been involved in, and I've made big mistakes, it was about information sharing, something I should have known and didn't. In fact, in the same article, Ellen Goodman says, this is what Carolyn Clancy, the director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, thinks of every morning when she gets her coffee. She thinks about how you and I communicate every morning when she gets her coffee. She says, it occurs to me that there's more double-checking and systematic avoidance of mistakes at Starbucks than at most healthcare institutions. I'm not sure she's wrong, right? And she's driving the budget. So it's about providing leadership, respecting human limits, promoting effective team functioning, which we don't do well now, and everybody knows it. And it's about anticipating the unexpected. High reliability organizations do that. I mean, the Navy does that because they have dangerous things like aircraft carriers. I would argue the same ought to be true of medicine. The most important distinguishing feature of high reliability organizations is they are absolutely preoccupied with the possibility of failure. Yeah, but what if this happened? Or what if that happened? They expect to make errors, and they train their workforce to recognize and recover them. And I would argue that's part of lean thinking and part of the principles that Steve was talking about. And they continually rehearse familiar scenarios of failure, and they strive hard to imagine novel ones. And that absolutely links to SurgePath. If we go back to this analysis of over a million cases looking at specimen deficits, the deficiencies in specimens were much lower for those laboratories that had a plan, right? They planned for the possibility that there would be a problem with specimens. The Joint Commission absolutely expects it, right? This has been on their list of national patient safety goals since 2005. All values defined as critical by the laboratory have to be reported to a responsible licensed caregiver, et cetera, et cetera. And that applies not just to the clinical labs, but to surgical pathology. And the AP checklist recognizes that from the CAP. You got to have that, right? The problem is what they really want is a policy. Demonstrating that you comply with your own policy is the challenge. And if you think this doesn't matter to our customers, think again. This is a satisfaction survey done by Dick Zarbo and others that looked at responses from surgeons about their satisfaction with various attributes of surgical pathology service. And if you look at those attributes that got the lowest rankings for customer satisfaction, notification of significant abnormal results and timeliness of reporting were at the bottom of the list, which probably surprises nobody. We recently implemented a critical values alert policy in surgical pathology at the University of Michigan, and I was not comforted that we had a policy. I mean, the hospital was delighted that we finally had a policy, but the problem with policy is not drafting it, right? Everybody spends a lot of time on that, but how do you get it done? How do you know you get it done? Ewell Belize was very helpful in putting together a tool using our existing outdated LIS that allowed us to really look at our success at implementing this policy. The idea was we defined our critical values, we got the policy endorsed, and the expectation is that critical values are urgently communicated. The question was, how often does that actually happen? So the tool that Ewell built was a daily report that goes to all signing faculty, and then a copy comes to me every day and to the director of SurgePath in my absence. He's looking at one today, I hope. And this is a strategy that really identifies things that in our LIS look like the sorts of things that ought to be within the purview of our critical values alert policy, and there's nothing on the report to suggest that any action was taken. If any action was taken, it wasn't documented. So it's really a wide net. It's meant to capture cases to which the policy might, but doesn't necessarily apply. And it's meant to capture cases on which action might not have been taken, but the issue might really be one of documentation, which becomes an educational issue rather than a practice issue. So what happens with that report is it's reconciled against the electronic medical record. So rather than guessing whether a value is within the definitions of our policy, we actually go to the medical record and see, right? And if it is, two things happen. The value is communicated, and there's an educational session with the responsible faculty, and that's really how we're closing the loop on communication of critical values. And the key really is what's the outcome of that tool. And it's been really rewarding. This blue line looks at the number of cases captured in the report which required action, and that you read on the right axis. And the black line are those cases actually in the report. So for example, in this month, which was a peak, there were nearly 40 cases captured in the report but none required action, meaning that it's highly sensitive but not very specific. In the several-month life of this tool, there have only been 4 cases in which action was required, and that's really the value of the tool because this is a low-frequency event. It's the sort of historical quality assurance value that we would have been proud of. We would have said, look, there's only been 4 times in the last 6 months where we missed the mark. That's not good enough. I don't want to be on the front page of the Ann Arbor News. What kind of problems? Well, here's an example. This patient here was a patient with a COPD and a new lung nodule, but no diagnosis yet. In fact, the patient had normal bronchoscopy. And because he had normal bronchoscopy, he had been scheduled for a PET scan 3 weeks following this lung biopsy, which yielded a diagnosis of carcinoma. And after that, the only thing the medical record said was that he was going to come back in 3 months about his COPD. Now, the pathologist who signed it out said, well, look, it was a lung biopsy in someone with a nodule. It was cancer. I thought they'd be looking for the report. But when we communicated the critical value, here was the surprising answer. Wow, we missed it. We'll cancel the PET scan. That's how you make a difference in medicine. That's how you save money. That's how you better serve patients. Communication cannot depend on publishing a report alone. In fact, I would argue that reports are lousy communication vehicles in today's busy practice environment. So we imagine all sorts of other electronic solutions. Well, we'll have an inbox. We'll have a flag. To clinicians who get about 200 flags a day, they're going to miss a flag. There's still a role for a telephone. As distasteful as that may be to some of my colleagues, I'm going to have to call somebody? Yeah, why not? It'll be fun, you'll see. Create a learning environment. Create an environment where this is fun. That's what Lean can do for you. It's about the principles. Now, that means you have to encourage reporting of reports, and that's hard for people in healthcare, right? But we're never happy when we screw up. Nobody wants to advertise that. You have to make sure nothing bad will happen to folks when they report these events. And you have to be serious about that. I find as people start to get into this, they know that's the right thing, but they don't really mean it, right? So they try to celebrate errors, but then there's this second conversation behind closed doors. Look, I told everybody I was happy about your mistake, but come on. You can't let this happen again. They'll know you don't mean it. Develop a culture in which communication flows freely regardless of authority gradient. This is huge in medicine, right? Nobody tells the professor in the operating room that he's about to screw up, even when 80% of the people in the room know it. When we were launching our error reduction strategy in 2000 in Rochester, Minnesota, I was sitting in a common sign-out area, and I was very excited about this new strategy. And I said to the residents who were in there were two of them, I said, look, if you knew I was about to screw up, you'd tell me, right? I said, no, sir. I thought, well, that's an issue of maturity. There was a surgical pathology fellow in that room. I said, what about you? You'd tell me. She said, nah, I don't think so. And there's a secretary dedicated to that area. And I said, come on, if you were about to release a report knowing that I had screwed up, would you tell me? And she said, well, that depends. I said, on what? She said, on how serious you are about all this new talk. Because that really doesn't fit with our historical experience. Our historical experience is, when we tell you you're about to screw up, you get pissed off. And although you may say that's mostly to yourself, it comes out differently. And we own that. That is not a learning culture. You've got to figure out ways to provide feedback in a way that makes people celebrate errors. And it's about recognizing that it's not the people, it's about the systems. And every system you have at home is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it currently gets. And that is not easy. Don Berwick knows it's not easy. Our workforce is blind to the enemy, especially in pathology. We don't have good data. It costs money in the short term, and that's hard to sell to your administrators in your hospital. And it's really a hard problem. It's one thing to talk about it, But doing something about it is the problem. It takes will. You got to want to do it. It takes ideas. And I would argue that most of the solutions reside in our home enterprises, but we haven't got good ways of hearing them or capturing them. And you got to figure out how to execute it. It means lean. It means Six Sigma. It means RFID. It means barcodes. The toolbox is rich. But you got to open it, and you got to mean it. And safety's just a piece of it. Medicine was still reeling from the 1999 report when the Institute of Medicine released its second report in 2001. And the chair of that committee, in USA Today, weekend edition, said patient safety was just the tip of the iceberg, to which medicine said, "You're kidding, there's more." He said, "Here's the rest." He said, "And the rest looks like this. We know that safety is important, but it's much bigger than that. Between the health care we have and the care we could have lies not just a gap. This isn't small, it's a chasm." And that's what they titled this report, Crossing the Quality Chasm. As the patient safety report was a call for action to make care safer, this report is a call for action to improve the American healthcare system as a whole in all of its quality dimensions for all Americans. In other words, you can't forget the other stuff because safety is hard. And the other stuff is not only safe, but effective, patient-centered, timely, efficient, equitable. And I would argue none of us measure up to this standard. Lean is about being effective. None of us are terribly patient-centered. I mean, have you ever seen what happens in pathology labs, especially surgical pathologists, when the secretary calls and says, "I got a patient on the phone. Ask him what it's about." Right? You ever hear that? "I don't want to take the call. I don't want to screw up. I don't want to interfere with their relationship with their doctor." You are their doctor. You know, then my faculty say, "I'm not their doctor." I say, "Did you send them a bill?" Maybe. You're their doctor. And that's what patient-centered care looks like. Answer the phone. And a good diagnosis done slowly is a bad outcome. Can't have it. And that's about redesigning systems. And it's about using information technology to support your processes, which historically we've not done well. It's about having the will, having the ideas, and having a way to put them into action. And I would argue that's where innovation comes in. Innovation I would define as redesigning the status quo in order to deliver new value. Innovation for innovation's sake, if it has no value, has no purpose. It's wasted effort. But it's innovation using some of our new technologies and new processes. And that's really my last conclusion. I absolutely believe we can do better. I love this stuff because I know we can be better, and that's what I want on the front page of USA Today. I want pathology to be the heroes that drive better healthcare, not the ones that are dragged along kicking and screaming as if it's somebody else's fault. By way of review, the third conclusion was that our complex processes set us up to fail. We commit significant errors at a low but predictable frequency, and we're built to ensure that every time, every month, every year. And the public isn't going to take it anymore, nor should you. My goal was that you leave here being able to list and assess patient safety risks in your own practices. I hope you're better armed to do that. And that perhaps, more importantly, you have some idea about what it means to develop strategies for reducing clinically significant diagnostic errors. Thank you for your attention.
All right, Jeff, have a seat. We'll see if there's any questions. I think we have a few moments, and we'd be glad to entertain some questions for Jeff.
Hi. I was just interested in your opinion. Do you think that most of the studies and articles that you cited are come from the late 90s in this current century? Is this a problem, in your opinion, that has always been there and it only has been recently publicized? Or do you feel that this is a reflection of a healthcare system that is more recent, you know, in the more recent times disintegrating? And the second part of my question is, have there been any studies that have looked at the national healthcare programs in Canada and or Europe and compared them to our system, and if there are any significant differences in the errors between them?
Great questions. With reference to the first, I think the problem is the same as it's been for decades. I don't think it's new. The way I often hear it framed is that what's changed is patient expectations. And I would argue patient expectations have always been the same. They just had no idea how badly they were getting screwed. You know, really, I mean, it's true, because when a lot of these publications come out, right, that's the response of our clinical colleagues. They've come to me many times and said, is this true? They didn't know it was true. And that's the public's response. So I would say public expectations have not changed a bit. But they had no idea how poorly we were meeting their expectations, and they're angry. And they should be. Fair enough. I don't know of any studies that compare performance in pathology in this country with performance in pathology in other countries. There is data in other countries, and that suggests that we're all in the same boat. I think pathology processes have been more or less the same in most places, and I don't know of anybody who has a huge advantage. Now, there are medical centers that are looking at their pathology very differently these days, and I think, you know, that's if you're not moving in that direction, you're already 10 years behind.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Jeff, one of the things we've started to do at Penn is to take a look at the total process. So really factoring in pre-analytic, what's happening in the offices, the ORs, the clinics, where the samples are coming from, in addition to what happens to them in the lab, and then also the post-analytic, what happens when we send them, particularly these days, into the electronic ethers. And what's been really enlightening and terribly frightening is the frequency of errors and where they occur when you look at the total process. A lot of what you showed was within the lab, but the actual size of the problem is dwarfed when you look at the pre and the post-analytic. Those processes, from our initial look at just one process, pap smears, it's an order of magnitude larger.
Yeah, that's a great comment, Michael, and our experience has been the same, both at Michigan and at Mayo. And I think one of the mind shifts that pathology has to make is recognizing that they own the process before it comes to their labs, right? Because our historical response would be, as I suspected, that's not our fault. Well, this isn't about who you blame. It's about getting it right, right? And so one of the first projects that came out of our error reduction strategy at Mayo had to do with how pap smears are identified in the offices, right? Because that was clearly the biggest piece of the pie. And so we could take the approach historically of saying, look, you guys have to fix that. Or what we did instead, since by that time we'd accumulated a fair amount of expertise in anatomic pathology on process redesign, on root cause analysis, et cetera, we offered them our team. We said, how about we come over and help you fix this? And that team, in a period of about a month, put together a process that reduced the number of requisition errors that reached our lab and specimen identification errors to zero. I will tell you that when we took that story and that message to surgical leadership at the Mayo Clinic, the initial response was, you know what, this is all fine and good, a lot of hyperbole. You know, they talk like surgeons. I actually thought hyperbole was a big word. but they said, you know, Jeff, you've set yourself up to fail because zero is not achievable. Sure, you got it here on pap smears, but zero is not achievable. And it was a great moment because the chair of anesthesiology was there. And he said, zero is the right target. In fact, it's the only target. And it's the target we've had in anesthesiology for 30 years. You know, they were talking about this stuff in the 70s. And it's about owning the whole thing. So if the process is flawed, you own it from beginning to end.
We took an approach where we did the FMEA and the root cause analysis with a team from the health system. It took almost a year of yelling and screaming and just being downright belligerent to the administration before we got their attention. Once we did, then it started going, you know, like a snowball downhill. But it really took a year of concerted error reporting, where we documented every mislabeling, we put it into a database reporting, and suddenly, you know, 300, 500, 600, 800 of these started showing up, and they really couldn't ignore that type of strong data. But you really got to get out there in front of it, and not just leave it up to the clinicians and the folks on the side. You've got to really own this piece, and it means an enormous amount of work.
No question about it. I think that's a great comment. I mean, at the end of the day, You know, I think you can inspire the folks within your own enterprise, but the folks who allocate resources don't understand that language. And that's okay. I mean, I don't blame them for that. I just recognize what they understand and what they don't. And you've got to have data, right? And that data has to be linked to dollar signs. And that's okay. But that'll take a lot of work. And I think pathology has avoided doing the hard work for a long time. What we've done a very poor job of is linking all of this to patient outcomes. Even today, I mean, there's a lot more literature on patient safety in pathology. The number of papers this year compared to last year and the year before that is much higher. I mean, the ball is starting to roll. And yet, if you look at the number of those publications that actually link to outcome, it's almost none. We link to other things and assume that they're appropriate surrogates to outcome. But those assumptions are not validated. So I think there's a ton of hard work to do, and some of that work has to translate into the language that moves those who allocate resources. Got to do it.
Questions? Please.
Since we're celebrating our errors and confessions here, this feels a little bit like a 12-step program. and I want to get mine out of the way first. I'm a recovering hospital CFO. I got paroled about 20 years ago, and I went into the technology business. And I was listening with interest as you talked about crossing the quality chasm. It's actually a takeoff on a book by a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Moore, who wrote about the technology adoption life cycle and how a lot of good technologies get caught in a chasm between as they get adopted. What we have in this room here are what Jeffrey Moore would call the innovators, that the leaders out there trying to look for new technologies to make their business better. But you can also tell that there's only probably 100 pathologists that showed up at this. As an industry, I look at healthcare as really being technology laggards from the information system side. Again, from a hospital CFO perspective, it was always developed for Medicare reimbursement to do the federal government's accounting. How do you get that to change? What is the change element or change agent that's really required to get the priorities shifted?
That's a great question, and I've thought about that a lot. I wore several hats when I was at the Mayo Clinic, and one of them was that I led an innovation team for a couple of years. And that was a question we thought about a lot, and I don't have the answer, number one. But I would say this. I would say that partly you motivate by having a different view of the future, which can be kind of a scary place. So, I mean, part of it is you have to get folks energized about their own welfare and future. I mean, for pathologists, that might mean that, look, if you don't figure out how you add value and what service means to those you serve, then your job's going to India or someplace else. And that transition means really embracing what it means to be a patient-centered pathologist. So I think one of the way you move culture is to really change the rules of engagement in big ways. And I think pathology has exactly that opportunity. I think technology is part of the piece where perhaps we've been slow adopters. I would argue the clinical labs have been much better at that than anatomic pathology, for sure. But I think if I were going to actually invest in one or the other, I think process redesign in pathology holds at least as much promise as technology, assuming links to an appropriately robust LIS, and that's a big if. So I guess that's a long-winded way of confessing I don't know the answer to your question, but I think it's the key question. And I think part of it is by changing pathology to a more patient-centered, service-oriented activity. I think that's really key. Do I want to mention my partnership with risk management? Well, now I have to. I mean, you have to be partnered with risk management. Risk management in the hospital where I currently reside understands that pathology is a key player in some of the things that cost them a lot of money. So that's part of what motivates the partnership. But they also have the expertise and tools that can help us be better. And so we've got a very active engagement with them. We've got an active engagement with the Michigan Quality System that Steve referenced in his talk.
Because one thing we do very poorly, at least in our anatomic pathology enterprise, and I don't think it's outside the norm in that regard, is process design. I mean, most of what we do is fractured. And I actually view that as the good news. I mean, imagine if we were as good as we could be and this was it. Now that would be depressing. I don't know if you had something else in mind, Steve. It is a strategy, but that doesn't necessarily connect the right dots. So Steve's comment was risk management can provide the financial argument to your hospital. And I never meet with risk management, but what they don't say that some of the things we do save them millions of dollars. What I always reply to them is, oh, really, I've not seen any of that yet. So I mean, you've got to make then connect that argument from risk management to those who actually hold the purse. And that can be more difficult.
One final question, if I may. I wonder if you could comment on the ongoing series of operational meetings that we have every week. Just given my past experience in four other institutions where the notion of a weekly AP operations meeting, which encompasses IT support, to me that was unheard of until I came to UM. And what is your common experience with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's part of what you do to move the culture. You know, when I had two residents, a fellow and a secretary, tell me that they would watch me make a mistake, I knew that we were not built in a way that would allow free communication across authority gradients. And part of that was we weren't as level an organization as we needed to be in terms of our hierarchical organizational chart. So I flattened it. And it was really liberating, because what I discovered, and it may be obvious to you and I'm a slow learner, was that we had all of the answers to these problems. They just weren't the folks to whom we traditionally listened, right? And so you have to figure that out. For me, the solution was to have an ongoing active relationship with all levels of the operational enterprise. And right now, I mean, it's always been true, but that's never been more true than it is for IT. I mean, absolutely, I think every big horror story I know about in pathology, and some are not avoidable. I mean, one of the ways we defined errors when we wanted to go to zero was preventable misdiagnoses that resulted in patient harm. And that can be hard to define, what's preventable, what isn't. But not all mistakes are preventable. Life is hard. Life is complicated. There are tough cases. But most of the horror stories that I think at the end of the day were preventable, somebody knew the answer. Somebody somewhere, and often that information resided in an information system that was siloed in a way that didn't make it accessible to the front-end operator. So IT has to be at the table. IT really holds the key to many of these solutions, I'm absolutely convinced. Not just in management tools, but building some of the forced functions that have to be part of process redesign. And simply using your QA'd data to remind people that you have policies and urging them to do better. I mean, we've been running that experiment for 50 years, and it doesn't work.